Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. For those of you who thought we lost our lease on the radio, we were off the air for a couple of weeks, but we are now back. And I am joined, as always, with my two beautiful co-hosts, handsome Jerry Oates and luscious Bobby Simmons. How you guys doing this evening?
I've been told worse.
Yeah, me. Well, I ain't real sure about me. Luscious. Oh, luscious. I'm doing wonderful.
Hey, well, you're doing good. Your Georgia Tech boys are doing good.
Well, they stubbed their toe last weekend, so.
I know, but
we'll see what happens in Miami this week. So, but it does make it fun to go out there when they're winning.
Alabama's going to win the national championship again this year, so.
I think you're right. I don't think LSU can hang with them boys.
No.
Now, have y'all heard that Les Bobby?
Yeah.
You big football man. Have you heard that Les Miles might go to Dallas?
There's rumors every year about him going somewhere. He was going to Michigan last year.
That'd have been a death sentence.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he's going anywhere. Alabama and LSU play, what, in 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah. Or, no, I think the Alabama-Auburn game's in 2 weeks.
No, that's after Thanksgiving.
That's toward the end.
That's after Thanksgiving. That's Thanksgiving weekend. They play. I know LSU plays Auburn this week. I think they play Alabama either next week or the week after.
Can you imagine what the ratings will be for that?
Oh, geez.
You think it'll be higher than Hogan's show with the midgets?
I know one thing. When we were in Slidell, you could not go to a place on a restaurant or any place on Saturday or Sunday that they weren't just jam packed in there wall to wall watching LSU on Saturday and the Saints on Sunday. We were worried about it affecting our shows on Sunday afternoon, even though they were playing in Tampa Bay. You know, people staying home and watch them on TV. The fans are that rabid, and they've always been that way, though, even when they were horrible.
Did it affect you?
I don't know. I didn't stay for the last show on Sunday. I had to take the owner of the circus to the airport in New Orleans, and so I eased on back and checked out of the hotel and slid over to Mobile Sunday night to visit my parents. But Ron said I talked to Ronnie on Monday morning. He said they had a good show.
You're good.
So it shouldn't affect us too bad. But all in all,
this,
the guys we did were real well in Louisiana.
Well, this hard to buck college football and pro football, I'll tell you that.
And there's nothing else to do down there. I mean, that's what them people live for.
Yeah.
I know when Ole was running there, Bobby, you was already gone. I'm pretty sure you were gone.
Yeah.
It might have been with the Georgia office. He ran Marietta on Super Bowl night. And we got there, I'm talking about nobody was there. He said, I don't know why I did this. Wow. It was awful.
One of the things he did when he took over, he thought he was a lot smarter than everybody else in the business. And he found out real quick. He he lost that business in a matter of 2 years, and he could have kept that thing going if he had did what he should have done and what people was telling him to do, but he wouldn't listen, so.
Well, there's a lot of them that way.
Certain things you can't do, you know, running against the Super Bowl is one of them. You know. And you got to, you know, another thing, and this is, you know, I'm not knocking anybody for making a living, but, I mean, the worst thing that happened in Atlanta, Georgia, was when they let Pedicino put them 7-8 hours of wrestling on Saturday night.
Yeah.
I mean, why go buy a ticket if you can watch 8 hours on Saturday night for nothing?
you know, when you overexpose anything, you know,
yep.
It's just.
And I mean, they were bringing tapes out of Dallas, and you know, let's face it, Dallas's production of their TV was a lot smoother than Georgia's. I mean, Georgia, we saw wrestling here, and for years and years, that's all everybody knew here was wrestling. But when they started bringing that stuff out of Dallas, and Michael Hayes and those guys went out there, and they started doing some crazy things, and then they were bringing the show out of Memphis here, and they'd been doing crazy things for years, you know, people started seeing other stuff, and they were like, wow.
Yeah. You mean something like that goes on and what y'all do?
Barnett had gone to New York. He was working for McMahon as his controller. And he called me, and he said, I hear some guy in Atlanta's got 7-8 hours of TV on Saturday night. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, would you tape it for me and send it to me? And I said, well, sure. So I taped 6 hours of it, and I mailed him the tape. And a week and a half later, I got a check for $150 from Titan Sports. I thought, you need any more tapes, Jim?
Yeah, I'll burn my VCR up, right?
Yes, sir. So that was my one and only check from Titan Sports. But, you know, it was – he just was curious because he – you know, a lot of people don't know Jim. For years and years and years, Jim played the political card to the hilt, man, where he would – you know, he knew who to talk to and whose palm to grease. And, you know, he kept – there was a guy here in the Atlanta area that had tried for years to get a boxing and wrestling commission started. And Jim knew enough people to keep that thing in committee where it could never get out. But, I mean, it was just – those are the kind of things you do when you're in business. You got to spend a little to make a little.
Those boxing and wrestling commissions, all they do is give somebody's buddy a job.
Oh, yeah.
Because everybody else a nightmare.
Exactly.
There's nothing for the athletes or nothing, you know.
No,
it's just
no.
To sell them a license. Didn't we have to buy a license in Atlanta at one time, Bobby?
The office paid for them. They were $5 a year.
If you worked in the
auditorium in Atlanta, you had to have a City of Atlanta license. They were $5 a year, and the office paid for them. I used to fill out the form every week and send it over there.
Did we ever get a license, per se?
Oh, yeah, they sent a little card. We just kept them in the office. It was a little blue card about the size of a driver's license.
Well, you owe me a card. I never got it.
The secretary typed it up for him, his thing over there, and it was the general manager of the auditorium and the civic center, the head guy, his name was Roy O. Elrod. I won't ever forget this guy's name. I never met him, but he always signed them.
But what was the purpose of that? What was the reason? What did they call it?
City made $5. They call it a wrestling, boxing wrestling license, City of Atlanta.
Oh, okay. No commission.
No, there wasn't a commission at all.
They were required to have them in Alabama and Mississippi as well.
Well, I'll tell you, I never bought one in Mississippi, thank you. But over in Alabama, I may have told y'all this, the reason that commission was dissolved over there is Barnett got Gulas to go in with him and they sued him. We ran Oxford, Alabama. Charlie Smith went over and set up a spot show at Oxford, Alabama. And we agreed to split the profits with Nick, his office. And I went over to run the town. And my wife is sitting right here next to me. She was working for me at the time. And I took her over to sell tickets. And Randy was tearing tickets. And we had Charlie McGowan took the ring over there. And Red was selling programs. And we were sitting there and we sold this place out. We probably turned away as many people as we put in there that night. And about 10 minutes before the show started, this guy walked in, threw a badge on me, and he was wearing a gun and told me he was from the Alabama Wrestling Boxing Wrestling Commission. And I looked at his badge, and Jerry Barber, who worked in the office for Nick, had come down to take care of, you know, to just oversee what we were doing. And Barber said, he's legit, Bobby. And when that guy left there that night, I had bought a license for every swinging soul there. Ticket takers, ticket sellers.
Oh, come on, buddy.
I'm the gospel truth. They were $5 or $6 a piece, but everybody there had a license. Now, I didn't have to buy a promoter's license because Barbara was there from Nashville, and we were running on Nick's license. And they went in the dressing room, and all the wrestlers from Georgia, I had to buy them a license. And plus, besides the license, when the guy left there that night, he took 19% of our house.
Did Barnett go crazy?
19%. I called Jim, told him. Jim said, what did he give us? I said, some little cards here. It says we got licenses. And he gave me a book, and I've still got it here somewhere. I've seen it not too long ago. It says Rules and Regulations of the Alabama Boxing and Wrestling Commission. And he, I mean, but 19% is what he took out of there. I mean, it was a chunk.
Tell him if anything happens to you, I'll be taking bids for it on eBay.
And yeah, Debbie said if anything happens to me, she'll be taking bids on eBay for that book. But it was just, you know, it was a scam. They didn't even check your blood pressure to see if you, you know, nothing. They just come in there and took your money.
What a joke. What a joke.
It was sad.
Well, guys, we're going to be joined tonight by Mr. Joe Dinky Go himself, 6'5" born. And I thought what we'd do this week, because he amazes me every time he's on the show and every time I talk to him. Anybody you mention, Dick will work with him or has some little story about him that between his wrestling career and his photography and everything, he got to know so many people. I thought it would be fun just to make a list of names and throw at him and see what he can tell us on each one of them. And even though it's mainly for him, if you anything you guys think of on any of the people that I'm naming, feel free to chime in. And if you can think of somebody that I don't mention, feel free to chime in on that as well, because I'm just rare to hear what Dickie's got to say about all these people. Like I said, he knows everybody and worked with so many people over his long career. I just thought this was interesting to do. So let me get him on the air with us.
Before you do that, Mike, let me say something here. For the people that are listening to us, I kind of want to apologize, you know, and I'm speaking for me. I can't speak for the other guys, but we kind of, our last show, we kind of let that thing get away from us, and there was some phone numbers that went out over the air. And that was not right of us, and we should have, you know, I say me, maybe I should have spoke up sooner, but, you know, we shouldn't, you know, it was just, it got away from us. It was funny at the time, but then, you know, it's just, I want to apologize to the people listening to us. We ain't going to let that happen again. That's just, you know, I mean, that's, I wouldn't want people belting out my home number over the radio, and that's
well, you can put mine out because I know nobody's gonna call me.
Yeah, well, me too. But I just, it bothered me a little bit, and people start getting calls, and it get back that we did it. It just, we got a lot of people that trust us, and I just, we ain't gonna let it happen again.
I won't give up. Dick's phone number, but it's got an 8 in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And if the person answering the phone says something about dial a sex number or something, don't worry about it. Just ask for it.
I wish somebody would call me.
You just think that just like because a few months ago I mentioned that somebody was paying $150 to talk to or what was it? $450 to talk to Blair for dinner.
I'll do it a lot cheaper than that, I believe.
Let me tell you guys a quick story. This is the God's honest truth, and it's embarrassing for me to tell it, but it's the truth if I ever told it. When my son was 17, I guess. He was. I started him umpiring. I umpired for 23 years, softball and baseball, and I started him umpiring. And he took to it like a duck to water. I mean, he really surprised me. He was good at it, and he's calling high school baseball in Columbus, Georgia right now. He just loves it, and he's good at it. But he come to me and he told me. He said, "Dad," he said, "I'm gonna make enough money this summer." He said, "Like a phone in my room," and I said, "Well, okay, no problem." So first month or so, everything went real well. It was in my name, you know, where he wouldn't have to put a deposit down, and everything went well. Second month, the bill came in. I opened the bill, and the bill was for like $400. And I looked at it, and it's got these 800 numbers or 888 numbers or whatever it was. And I thought, my God, what is this? So I called him. He come in, and I told him, I said, look, we got to talk. I said, what is this? And he goes, well, just he said, I lay up there at night, and I call his number and listen, you know, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. Well, now, I'm thinking he's calling these late-night numbers, you know, call Sally at 1-888 and let's talk. He was calling 1-888-WRESTLE. It was WCW's dial their number to find out what was going on in the wrestling business.
He could have called me for nothing, and I'd have told him nothing.
Bubba, I was embarrassed. It hurt me. I said, listen, if you'll give me, you know, this is $400. I said, if you'll give me $100, I said, I'll tell you anything you want to know. If I don't know, I'll call somebody and find out for you. That's the true story. I mean, it was awful.
When I finish it, don't.
Yeah, but then when I paid him at the end of the summer and I took the $400 out of his check, that look was priceless.
Well, how are you this evening, Mr. Steinborn?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing wonderful.
Good. You know, you were talking a little while ago about the commissioner. When I went to Knoxville, Ron Fuller wanted me to come over there, and he wanted me to wrestle over there. So I went over there with a mask on and called myself the Gladiator. After 1 year of being there, he says, can you stick around and work in the office? I said, sure. So I stayed another year. He bought an $8,000 Canon movie camera. I used to get up on top of that stadium, and I'd film the matches and run them to the TV station and then drop them in for the interviews. The next. Anyway, he gets a letter from the commission. He gets a letter from the, I think it was the government, stating there was a meeting in Memphis. They're trying to demolish the Athletic Commission in Tennessee. So I represented Ron Fuller and went over there. And it was a big meeting with a bunch of dignitaries. And finally, one guy sat down with me. I said, what's going on? He says, you guys are paying an absorbent amount each year. He says, for every one of your shows, he says, you have to have an American Legion sign off or Veterans of Foreign War sign off. They have to be your sponsor. So you go into a town, you have to search out that sponsor. Even if they don't have a building, they had the buildings years ago, but now they got coliseums. But you still had to go through that little, now a bar in the side of a building, American Legion or whatever, and give them a certain percent. Well, they added up the percentage and found out there was so much money, $40,000 to $50,000 a year, and these commissioners were going to Las Vegas spending it. So they called it the Sunset Law, which means that was when Kennedy came in. They demolished it. That's when there was no more. Anybody could be a referee. Anybody could wrestle. It was entertainment. So that's the part I knew about demolishing the Athletic Commission in Tennessee. So.
Well, I know back, or at least I had read back in the 50s, I guess, whenever they were trying to get the NWA as being a monopoly and all that, that Mick Doolittle evidently was close to Estes Kefauver, who was the United States Senator from Tennessee, or one of them, and had him intervene with the Justice Department and kind of had that put off. I think they eventually got around all that by under the table forming the Worldwide Wrestling Federation and the American Wrestling Association with Gagne and Vince Sr., but it was still, you know, in name only. They had their own champions, and but they all swapped talent and all worked together. It was a collaboration. So
You know how that all started? They had a National Wrestling Alliance every year, and 1 year, an undercover guy for the FBI infiltrated and sat there. He was supposed to be representing somebody who didn't show up or whatever, and the promoters were talking about monopolizing and knocking this guy, and don't use this guy because he's chasing after the young girls and so forth. and the guy turned him in. That's how it upset the whole thing. And even in those days, when Musnick was the champ, was the president, he didn't want it anymore. So they dumped it on Graham, and then they dumped it on Geigel, or Graham, one of them, and they took it for just a while before they could be brought to justice. It was switched to somebody else, and then Barnett took over. And that's what I know of that. But that's how, in my early years in the business, that's what we heard. That's why Gagne went for the AWA. He says, Carver wanted Fez to come around to all these different territories and defend his title. Well, TV hit, and every little territory got their own little champion. And Gagne says, I can't wait. So he formed his own territory, his own championship, his own referees.
Yeah. Well, let's start throwing some names at Mr. Steinborn and see what he can.
Guys, you guys jump in if you know him too, because, go for it.
Well, the first name on my list was somebody that was big in the Mobile territory and throughout Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama in the late 40s, early 50s, and into the middle 50s, and that was Nick Carter. And he was probably, his heyday was before your time, but I was just wondering if you ever came across him. He's one of those that you just never hear much about.
Yeah, he was a veteran going out of the business when I was coming into the business. I think in 1954, I was in Tennessee, and I ran into him. And I remember he had a big nose. He was a big guy, too. And he was funny in the dressing room. Last I heard, he was dating some lady or living behind a outdoor movie screen somewhere in Alabama. He was there about 4 or 5 years. Did you hear anything about that, Mike?
No, I lost track of him. I know. I'm pretty sure he was still involved with Carson White running up around Boaz and Gadsden and places like that in the early.
Yeah, it was in Gadsden. That's where he was. Last I heard, he was in Gadsden. Well, yeah, they were together, but when that folded, he just settled down. I think this woman had inherited to her family this outdoor movie screen, and there was an apartment right built behind it. And I think he was there for 4 or 5 years. Charlie Carr told me that.
Wow.
So. But, you're going back to where. You're going back 50 years. She was.
Another guy that worked in and around that same time frame. And Dick and I were talking about this guy earlier today when we were talking this afternoon. And we were thinking somehow, Jerry, he ended up maybe doing some stuff with you when you were running Columbus, and that's Rex Mobley. Does that name sound familiar to you?
Rex Mobley?
Yeah.
Wasn't he your booker, Jerry?
No, I never heard that name, Dickie.
Who was your booker?
Me.
No, you brought somebody in. He stayed a short time and left.
Buck Robley.
Buck Robley. Who were you asking about, Mike?
Rex Mobley. He was from.
That's why I'm confused.
Ran out of Hattiesburg. He had the Hattiesburg promotion before the Welches went in there in the 50s.
No, I don't know him, but I knew the other Mobley. So,
how about Jules Speedy Lawrence?
Yeah. Didn't he have a brother?
He had a guy that worked as his brother. I don't know if they
That's
were actual
what it
brothers
was.
Or not. I'm trying to think what his. I think he was, what was his name? I don't remember what his name was. But it started with a J as well. But they looked close enough like where they could have been brothers.
Yeah, Speedy looked like Tito Coppa. Short with that bald head, Jimmy Osturi, same look. You know, when I was young in the business and 18 years of age and 19 years of age in Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia, Reading, Pennsylvania, New York, Connecticut, and at a young age like that, these guys were just, 1 or 2 years away from getting out of the business. So they did jobs, you got to know him better in the dressing room than you did in the ring. Because when you got in the ring with them, that was that old style still there, and you had to adjust to it. So he said, "What's next?"
Yeah, I don't know where he's getting these names. I totally lost.
Oh, by the way, before we go any further, you're right, Bobby, about the phone numbers, and I shouldn't have led Billy Wicks into that. But you know, Billy, I think he's in a wheelchair, and he's very alert, and I call him every now and then. But he gave me Bockwinkel's number, so I heard that he had a little dementia, and I had known Nick for years, so I called him on the phone, and I said, "Nick, this is Dick," and on. So we got a little talk and so forth, and I said, "Look, I hear you had a little setback," and he hesitated. I said, there's a couple of things between dementia and Alzheimer's. I said, dementia is when you've lost your keys in the house. You can't find them, but then you find your keys and you're happy. Alzheimer's is when you lost your keys in your house, and when you find your keys, you don't know what the hell the keys go to. And he started laughing. And I said, we all have that. We've got these stories. Why don't you write a book? I says, I've got so many pages of mine and so forth, and I was bringing it forward. And then I could tell there was a difference. He hesitates, and he follows through, and then he agrees with you, and then he comes back and agrees again and floats over that, and he admitted it. He says, I don't know what to do about that. So, I talked to Donnie Fargo, and Donnie Fargo's dad is a doctor. And Donnie, who was 83, he says, "Dad, how can I stop from getting Alzheimer's?" He says, "Before you go to sleep at night," he says, "think of all the guys you wrestled and all the events. That's the closest thing that you have, that you built, and that you've, it's part of your psychology and your subconscious." So I was telling him that. You know what he finally agreed to? I was really surprised. He says, "What we should do with this coming convention," he says. I said, "When's the next convention?" Meaning what date? Like March 29th or whatever. He said, "It's next year sometime, March or April." Geez, I knew that wasn't right. He should have known. So he says, "I'd like to get a special day." He said, "They got this cribbage tournament going on, and I'd like to call this the Dementia Room." And he says, "Put it in the program. Before you guys are gone, the stories that you have," and he said, "because I got a lot of stories." And I said, "You're right." I said, "We should put a film up there, and you could make it into CDs and so forth." And he was really into it. And I was wondering if he was just ribbing me, or he was accepting the fact that everybody else is accepting the fact that he has what he was now talking about. So I said, go ahead.
I had lunch with Mac McMurray last Saturday. And he said that he spent some time with Nick here in Atlanta when they had that convention here last month. And he said, until you spend time with him, you can't really tell how bad it is. I noticed it last year. I mean, we all know how fluent and how glib Nick was, and how he could talk about anything. I mean, he could make the fuzz on a peach sound interesting. And he can't. I mean, they have to write down what they want him to say now. He's still president of the Cauliflower Alley Club, but they have to write down what they want him to say, and it's just, it's really sad.
How old is he?
He's 2 years older than younger than me. He's 70. He's 76. Because he asked me, he says, "How old are you?" And I said, 78. I says, "And you?" He says, "Well," I said, "you got me by 2 years." So I was in Australia with him. We lived in the same apartment together for 5 months. I worked with him in Atlanta. He walked in the ring, and I'm standing there. I was really over there, and he walks up to me with the Easy Championship. And he walks up to me, and he leans right over me, and he gets right close to my face, about 2 inches from my face. He says, "I will lead the match. I will call all the high spots, and you will do exactly as I say. Do you understand?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes back. And I turned around, I took my jacket off, and he turned around. By the time he turned around, I hit him with two drop kicks.
No, what's coming either?
and he was going to call the match. Excuse me.
The amazing thing about him is he was still what, world champion in the, into his 50s, wasn't he? The last run he had with the world title for Vern. And
yeah.
To watch him work and everything, you'd never be able to tell it. I mean, I've seen, you know, I saw him work. Unfortunately, I never got the chance to see him work when he was in Georgia. I saw him work when he first went to the AWA in the early 70s. And never diminished a bit. I mean, you know, you look at guys like Flair and people who are still working into their 60s now. And, you know, their work is definitely nowhere near what it was at their peak. But I don't think Bockwinkle ever missed a step whatsoever as far as working in the ring.
Yeah.
Well, I got a name for you, Dickie.
Who?
Gene Stanley. I remember seeing him as a kid at the arena in Columbus.
Really?
Yep. What kind of worker was he? Was you around him much?
Huge, yes. What are you talking about? My dad was a partner in the promotion in New York. We had Rudy Miller, Toots Mont, and my dad were the three partners in their first shows in Madison Square Garden with Anthony the Rocker and so forth. And they brought in Gene Stanley. And Rocker was over like nobody's business. And he was jumping around like a frog in the ring. And here comes this Gene Stanley. And Gene Stanley had the first strut. It was the most authentic strut I've ever seen. And the reason he had a strut is because he was bow-legged.
That's right. He sure
and
was.
When he walked, when he walked to the right, it seemed that the leg that was put down straight all of a sudden bent a little bit to the right. And he compensated for that by throwing out the hip. By the time the left leg went down straight and it bent a little bit to the left, his hip went that way. By the time he walked, it was a gape, and it was a natural strut. He was around New York. And I was in the dressing room with him. I used to bring his robe back to the house, 15, 16 years of age, back to the dressing room. He came to my dad's house. We had dinner one time, and he talked with a lisp. And he talked like Rogers. He talked with a little bit of a lisp. And I saw him in Madison Square Garden. That's when I really knew I wanted to be a professional wrestler. I walked out into Madison Square Garden and looked out of the dressing room and looked at this sellout crowd of 19,000 people and looked up there. I looked up and it's one of those things, where else can you see something like this unless you're in Madison Square Garden with 19,000 people and you're looking up at those three tiers and the ring? And I remember Tom Pearl Furpo was in the ring, and I said to myself, I want to be here always. And I meant that. And it was like an injection into my system. And I said to myself, that's it. And eventually worked in front of 38,000 people in Chicago Stadium when Rogers defeated O'Connor the title. All this history. You know, you look back at your age and you look back and you look back and you say, hey, it can't be repeated. It's not there anymore. Like Napoleon said, there's no future in the past. All our past, it's the truth. There's no future in the past. I mean, you can hang on to it, remember it, and talk about it, and say I should have and I shouldn't have, but there's no future in that.
where was he from, Dickie?
Chicago,
correct. His name was something like Jablinski.
He was
Polish. Polish. He was Polish, and his brother was Steve.
Right. And I think after Steve got out, or after, maybe it was after Gene retired, they used Bob Merrill, who was.
Oh, I remember that. Evans.
He was Bob Stanley.
Oh, that's right. You know, I now remember. I was sitting in the dressing room in St. Nicholas Arena, 16 or 17 years of age. And Rogers was going to go in the ring with Gene Stanley. The office put this match together to see how these two, how they were going to choose, who was going to be what, or whether. But somehow they didn't trust Buddy. because Buddy had the reputation of, and he did it to one guy in Ohio. He got him in the giant swing. He got him, he's got the boots underneath his armpits, and he started swinging them in a circle, and the guy went up, you know, but he let him go. He went through the second rope into the chairs and the people, and that got around the wrestling world. There was no television at the time. Now they're booking the first time together in St. Nick's, and I'm in the dressing room, and I hear Rogers tell Stanley, "I'll take the first fall with the giant swing." And I heard Stanley said, "No, I'll take the first fall with what I want to take." And then they worked out something else later on, but they didn't trust him. Then the office realized that too, and they just kind of pushed Buddy out. He went back to Ohio. Stanley was the star.
He was an impressive-looking guy. But he wasn't a real big guy, though, was he?
Well, he had a nice body. Here's what, I got pretty close with him, I says. In fact, I got a picture someplace. I got a picture of him. I got a couple of pictures. One is at the Atlanta Penitentiary. He's when we all went there to he was there the year before me. Bibble McCoy said he's sitting there and he's got his bicep up. He told me that when he was in Guam, I don't know if he was the Seabees or the Navy or something, but when they were liberating them and they were now bringing in the ships and they bringing in the ones closest to the beach now loaded 2,000, 3,000 sailors or Seabees onto the ship and they took off. The guys up on the hill, he said, which is like a half a mile away, they dismantled their tents. They came all the way down to the, but then the next one, and then it was like a lineup. And he said it was like five units. And he says they also had recreation. He says, and they needed some guy to wrestle with somebody. And some guy was in the, who used to wrestle in California. He just wanted a bodybuilder. He said he grabbed him and he says, "Let's just put on these shows for the guys." And he says, "Heck," he says, I got so enthused about learning this. He says, by the time, he says, 4 or 5 weeks later, our tents were supposed to go down on the beach. He says, I took my tent and went way back up on the top and started all over again because, he says, I kept entertaining. I said, how long did you do this? He says, 8 months. That's how he learned how to work. Whoever he was with that time had that ring up and they were entertaining these guys who were going home when the war was over. He was dark. He had a mask on. He weighed about 198 pounds, and he was about 6 foot and a half or something. But he was really over in New York. Gee whiz. When he came in the ring at Madison Square Garden, he must have had 15 to 20 women, gorgeous women with beautiful dresses, and walking around to the audience giving out these cookies that they had made in the shape of Gene Stanley. It was amazing. He was one of the first idols as far as it comes to blondes. Then Gorgeous George hit the scene.
Well, I was impressed with him as a kid. I thought he was something.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I went to the Cauliflower Alley Club in Los Angeles. And he was sitting at the table with his brother. And Carl Lawler told me, he said, "You know who that over there?" I said, "Who?" He says, "Gene Stanley." God, I couldn't wait to get over there. I sat down in front of him and looked him in the face. I said, "You remember me?" And he says, "No." Hurt my feelings. I says, "I used to, and you know, in the wrestling business, no wrestler likes to hear somebody come up to you and say, 'Oh, I remember, you remember me, I used to carry your bag.'"
Yeah.
Well, here's the same thing. Here he's sitting in front of me, 81 years of age, and I'm saying to him, "Don't you remember me back in Jamaica Arena? I used to carry your robe back from the ring to the dressing room." And then I says, "I'm Milo Steinwood's son, Dick Steinwood." Then he looked and he stared at me, and you could see the hesitation there also, all these years in between. And then I'm sure he remembered Milo had a son, but he didn't remember me directly, I guess.
And he was 81 at the time.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, Scott Peel, I took a picture. Scott was there, took a picture, he and I together. and he put it on one of his whatever happened to programs. Oh, I was so proud of that thing. God, you could see the smile on my face. I mean, this guy was, you know, Rocker was, he wasn't a wrestler. He was a jumping bean, and he was a rugby player, and he jumped up on your shoulders and did a forward roll, and he hit you with dropkick after dropkick. He was different. He was what the people needed in New York. And Stanley was the good old boy with the blonde hair and the strut and saying, and everybody thought he was gay. He was just the opposite. He lost a lot of money. He invested in a stock where the glass on your automobile, the windshield in front of you, would be the speedometer and the gas mileage and so forth. All those things that you're looking down below your wheel would be up on the glass. But about 2 inches up and all the way across. He was telling us about it. He put a lot of money into it, and I think the government stopped it. I don't know why. I guess common sense of glass breaks, you know, then you have to, or if something was wrong or a fuse breaks or something, you don't have any gas in your lights underneath in your glass or anything. So it just fell through for me.
That's sad.
You mentioned Rocker, and this is totally off the wall here, but Charlie Smith told me this story because he refereed the match. I don't know if you were here or not, Dick, but you may have heard something about it. They ran a when Sputnik was here, and he was so over as the top heel. And I was just a kid, but I can remember going to see this match at Ponce de Leon Ballpark. The main event was Rocker and Sputnik. And evidently Buddy Fuller was booking, and he went to Rocker and told Rocker to beat Sputnik. And then he went over to the other dressing room and he told Sputnik to beat Rocker. And Charlie said when they got in the ring, he said he was the only guy in the ring that knew they were going to try to beat each other. And he said neither one could beat the other.
Do you know that you just reminded me I was at ringside and I watched that happen?
Did you? I mean, I
oh, yes.
He told
me
the story. And I thought, God, you know, it's just what I mean, as a referee, I tried to look at it from a referee's perspective. All you can do is stay out of the way.
Yeah. And, you know, let's face it. If you're the booker and you own the territory and your name is Buddy Fuller, who are you going to push? You're the head man. The only guy that's going to draw you any money is Sputnik.
Yep.
And here you bring this guy down from New York who's on the last leg, and he's going to draw from his, and he doesn't want him to sell. He just wants him to eat him up. So, of course, he had to tell Rocker the same thing, and he told Sputnik. And he probably told Sputnik, he told Rocker that he was going to do that. So that was a smart move as a promoter. But Rocker should have adjusted to it. He should have just sold as quick as possible, done as much as possible, and lost. And he would have brought him back, and he would have got on TV and whatever, and says, "I was sick. Now I want to come back." And he would have never know.
When I've seen Rocker, he didn't sell for anybody at any time. That's the only one I've ever seen him. Make him cooperate with Thez, which he didn't have a choice then.
That's right. Hey, I was at Madison Square Garden where Bob Orton, teaming with Buddy Rogers, went in the ring with Antonino Rocca and Miguel Perez. And it was supposed to be 2 out of 3 falls, but by the time they got in the ring, it was like 14 minutes to 11, and Johnny Addy, who was the ring announcer, he gets in the ring and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, this will be a one-fall match, a one-fall," and Rocker didn't hear this. And they had agreed he's going to lose to a pile driver. So I just, about 4 minutes before the curfew, he pile drivers Rocker. And 1, 2, 3, and he's on his chest. And he rolls out of the ring, Rogers. And the people get up and put their hats on, and the doors open from the side of the Madison Square Garden, and everybody's leaving the building. And I'm watching, and I see Rocker laying there, and all of a sudden he sits up like nothing happened. And he's looking around to the right, and he's looking to the left, and he rolls around to his knees, and he looks up like, what the hell's going on?
It's over.
that's unreal. see, we should be in the movies.
Well,
before
the
you guys
for you.
Go,
Al
before
you get Galindo,
that's Spidey Galindo.
You know, I was raised in New York and learned the wrestling up there and learned it in the gym and Rogers in my aisle, and now I come down to the South. Holy crap. What goes on in Georgia? And then what goes on in Mississippi and Louisiana? So I get down there, I'm working for Lee Fields in Mobile, and he sends me over to Louisiana, and I go into this club. And Galindo goes in the ring, and he's got this long blonde hair. He looks like a reproduction of Jesus Christ. He's got this long hair, and he's got a clothespin hooked to the back of his hair. And he comes in the ring, and he walks the whole circle of the ring, and everybody spots this clothespin behind his hair. And finally, the opponent comes in, and he complains, and then the referee tries to walk Galindo around, but he won't turn his head around, and so forth. Well, the match went on or whatever, and he pulled one out of his tights. Now he's got this clothespin. He's scraping it in the guy's eye, and the guy goes down. And it was like a little master guard someplace in a small town. 200-300 people. And there was a young girl and her husband. And she was like about 19, just married, I guess. And he was sitting there. And she got up, and she walked over that ring, and she pounded both hands on that side of that apron. And she says, "He beat that guy with the clothespin, scraped him in the eye." And the referee said, "What are you talking about?" And I heard Galindo walk to the edge of the ring, and he says, "You better keep your mouth shut." And he shut it, pointed at her. He says, "Or I'll beat the hell out of you, and I'll make love to him." And he pointed to the husband. And that woman stopped. She looked. He's going to beat the hell out of her and make love to the husband. Instead of just the opposite. It may not be funny, but at that time I says, holy crap, he's got reverse psychology. He stopped to run up tracks.
And was that Mario or Al?
Al.
Mario.
No, it was Al Galindo.
Was he tough? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh,
I
always
heard he was.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, he was... that's why they call him Spider. He was very, very flexible and very limber. Worked with him a couple of times. And he was too limber. You know, some of those guys, you know, you get a hold and all of a sudden they get into a position where the people know it's not hurting. He's so damn limber.
You know, he was married to Helen Hill before she married... DiBiase's father, and before she married Mike DiBiase.
He married who?
Helen Hill, the girl wrestler.
But Helen Hill, you know who Helen Hill was married to first time?
Who's that?
Buddy Rogers. That was
really?
His first wife. Yes, that was his first wife, Helen Hill.
I guess Galindo was her second husband then.
Yes.
And then she was married to
Let me tell you something. I was in the convertible with Buddy Rogers going from Tampa down to Fort Lauderdale, and he was driving his rented car. I was sitting in the back, and somebody was in the front, and we were talking about Joe Lewis. And Joe Lewis was complaining because when he wrestled in St. Pete the night before, there was a big sign outside that said no colored allowed, and he was really pissed off, and they had all the press there and everything. And I said something about the blacks and so forth, and he looked, and he was riding, and he had his left hand on the wheel and his right arm across the seat, and he says, "Well, I know what it's like to be with the colored because I'm married to one." And he was.
Yeah,
and I saw her. And he had a daughter by the name of Janine. I think it was Janine. I think so. He had a daughter with her. I don't know if he was married to her years later or at the end of his life. I don't know that. Do you know that, Mike?
No, I don't. I knew that he was married to Helen Hill. I knew she was married to Galento, and then DiBiase's father, and then, Iron Mike DiBiase, who adopted Ted. But Galento, back to Al Galento, his second wife, I guess it was a stripper in Atlanta. And the reason I know all this, one evening last week, I was going through some newspaper sites just looking at stuff, and there was a story in there where Galento's wife had they had separated or something because he was working out on the West Coast, and she committed suicide by running her car into a wall at 125 miles an hour.
In Atlanta?
In Atlanta, yeah, in Atlanta.
I think I remember that. That's right. That's right. I remember that. I couldn't remember the name, but I know somebody did that. Gee whiz.
Nikki, you talked a couple of weeks ago about the best two girls you ever saw. Who did you say they were?
Terry Majors and Carol Carrata. They came from Columbus, Ohio, and there was a pro out there who was a policeman, and he worked part-time for Al Haft. And these girls wanted to learn how to become a pro wrestler. He said, well, if you're going to be a pro wrestler, you've got to learn something about wrestling. So he evidently produced a lot of amateur and mixed it up with professionals. So these two girls knew how to work together with each other. When I was in Florida, they came. Wrestling was only in the wintertime in Florida. Opened up in the middle of October, November, December, January. They closed up. That was it. There was no wrestling down there. So the Snowbirds came down. Well, girl wrestling, or midgets, produced by Cowboy Luttrell in all the five or six towns, drew a lot of money in the wintertime. So they brought the girls down. Well, Moomer had her bunch, but these two girls were independent. They got in that ring, and, man, they made so many nice moves in Daytona. I saw them on Tuesday night in Tampa. I said, how about if we get in the ring and work out next Saturday in Daytona? And they said, yeah, I got in the ring with both of them. I showed them some of my moves. They showed them some of their moves. They wanted to know something different because Cowboy had booked them together for 2 weeks in a row, you know, in every town. So they can't do the same thing. So I was trying to help them out with that. Then Jesse James started dating Perry Majors. And he was making trips with her, and Frank James was down there. And another wrestler down there at the time was by the name of Kowalski, not Killer Kowalski, but this guy was a short guy with a bald head with a big beard. And pardon me?
Carl Kowalski.
Carl Kowalski, yeah, he married Carol Carrata.
Yep.
Yeah. They were the best girl wrestlers I knew.
Yeah, I just couldn't remember what names you said they were.
Yeah. Terry's a good one. Terry looked like Debbie Reynolds. Not like Debbie Reynolds. My girlfriend back in those days was
Debbie Reynolds ended up marrying Jesse James. They were married for several years.
Yeah, they lived together in Nashville in the Dickinson Trailer Park. My girlfriend was Betty Hawkins. Man, I went to Chicago when I was about 19 years of age. And there were four girls there, and this Betty Hawkins snatched me up, and we walked the beach in Chicago until 6 o'clock in the morning. It was one of those romantic things that you go through in your life, and she was 4 years older than me. And over the years, we used to write each other, and I bought a pair of boots from Hildegard and sent them to her for her birthday, and she sent me something else for my birthday. And it was a romantic, on-the-road, I love this wrestler, and she loves me, and she winds up marrying Brute Bernard. She went from one extreme to the other.
Brute Bernard.
Yes, she did.
That's a true story. Oh, shoot.
What year was that, Dick?
What year?
When you were
to Chicago?
Yeah, when you bought the boots from Hildegard and sent to her.
Probably, let's see, 56, maybe 57.
You were the last of the big spenders, brother. What'd they cost back then?
$27.
Oh, come on now. Our first pair I bought from them in like 71 was $12.
They were used, Bobby. They didn't take
No, I thought, you're right, you're right. I think they were like 16 cents, but when you put the initials on the side,
oh, huge. Go customize.
And then you had two colors. You had the trim around, it was red, and you had the gray on the inside. And I bought the same boots. I had the same boots, but I used to tell them, I used to write and say, I says, when you put your boots on tonight, I'm going to put my boots on. I'll be thinking of you. Let's have a good night. You're crazy. You're crazy.
I used to buy those boots from Hildegard. I spent more money at the local shoe store there in Hakeville, where the guy would put about an inch on the bottom of them for me. Because when you got them from Hildegard, if you didn't put something on the bottom, they were like water skiing.
They were slick. I don't know how I got a pair of Dickies boots that was from there, had that bottom on them. I couldn't stand them. I don't know how y'all worked in them all those years. God, they were slick.
You know,
they were, Bobby.
You know,
like
when I was
glass.
In Australia, Sid Freeman and I, and Seymour Cornick, we went from Sydney to Bondi Beach. So we catch the bus, and it's like 40 minutes. And I look on the left-hand side, and it says Shoe Factory. Shoe Factory, it was like a little store. So we're coming back. We stop the bus. I go inside, and I said, can you make some boots? And he said, yeah. So he takes me in the back. He's got about 7-8 people working for him. He's got 4 or 5 machines in a small area. So I go back to the hotel, bring back my boot from Hildegard, give it to him. The next week, he gives me a pair of boots, shark skin, then a kangaroo skin, and then some other animal and so forth. I got a pair a week. I paid $22 a pair. And what he did was, the inside leather and the outside leather, he opened up. And he put strips all the way across, like 1-inch strips all the way across and a 1/2 inch down, another strip. That way, when you tightened up your boots and you sweated, they never really came together. They held back. The leather held back and they wouldn't loosen up and from sweat and so forth and pull the laces together, which Hildegard's boots did.
Yeah.
So I had I left Australia with an extra suitcase with 10 wrestling boots pairs in there. Got to Hawaii and Lord Jam Blair's. I brought 2 of them to the dressing room and I says, anybody want to buy these boots? $30 a pair. They snatched them up to they were beautiful. They were the nicest made boots. In fact, when I got to the States years later, I sent an order over there and the guy sent me 2 boots back. And they had to go through duty and it was, and they didn't put the leather on the in, I mean the strips on the inside, and it was a wrong move.
But you got my first pair from there, and I still have them.
From Australia?
Yep. When we were in Orlando, you ordered them for me. I still have them.
I'll be damned. You know, I was really interested one time when I was in Houston. I went to Paul Bosch's office. And on his desk, this big desk with all the paper and all the stuff and stuff in the book, on the right-hand side, when you sat there, he had like a little square wood, maybe 12 by 12. Then he had a 2x4 coming up about 4 feet, 2 feet, with a nail on it. And it was all bronzed or whatever. And he had a pair of wrestling boots hung up on it. And they were bronzed. I said, Paul, I says, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's when I hung up my boots. He hung them up. It was
like
over.
That.
Yeah, it was terrific.
I was going to say, Don Curtis bronzed his wrestling boots when he retired. He's the only other person I've
ever
heard
them?
Of.
No kidding.
What's that? Yeah. All right, here's one
really?
For you. Hanson Johnny Barron.
Handsome Johnny Barron. Gee whiz. When I lived in Richmond, Virginia in 1952, Tootsmot started promoting in Chicago after selling his business in New York. And he called me up. He says, can you come out to Chicago? I said, yeah. I said, I'm in the National Guard on Tuesday night, so I'll fly you back and forth. So 8 or 9 weeks, I flew to Chicago and flew back. And I met Johnny Barron out there. And handsome guy, was in love with himself, thought he could get over in the wrestling business and on TV in the Rainbow Arena because of his looks and so forth. But there were too many guys making too many good moves, and he faded out. I had a Leica camera with me. I always took pictures of everybody, all the wrestlers in those days. Still got them. I got a picture of him. It proves that he was on an ego trip because he's standing there with a suit on, and I swear to you, he must have bought the suit from somebody from Ohio. He was from Columbus, I think, to Chicago, because the suit didn't fit. I mean, the shoulders just hung off. I mean, it was ridiculous. Even if he tried to bring it in closer to his shoulders, and he was proud of it. He was standing there smiling. And last time I saw him was in Chicago. I mean, it wasn't much of a career that he had. Johnny Barron,
With Rogers, you know, Rogers always, wherever he went, he carried a crew with him. And,
correct.
Baron and Magnificent Maurice and Johnny Valentine.
You're right. Magnificent. You're right. That's
yep.
right.
And,
that's right.
But he seemed to go wherever Rogers went. And then he wound up in Hawaii and kind of homesteaded over there and spent most of the late 60s into the 70s there.
That's right. I remember that now. Gosh.
He married a young girl from Hawaii. And then he moved back to, I think he was originally from either Rochester, New York, or Buffalo, New York. And he ended up back up
that way
a few years ago. And he passed away just a month or so ago.
No kidding.
Yeah.
God. Let me tell you a story of a stupid thing I did. When Rogers and I was in that convertible going to Fort Lauderdale, he just reminded me this because he had a crew. He had a system of doing it, and he knew what he was doing. He says to me, and it goes to show you how inexperienced I was to the game, how stupid I was. He says, Ricky, he said, what I want to do, he said, I'm going to bring you into a territory, and I'm going to get you over. And he says, I'll come in, and he says, we'll work a couple-week program, he says, and I'll take the title, and I'll move on. And you know what I said to him, sitting in this car? I said, yeah, and I know what you're going to do. You're going to beat me, and I'm going to lose. And I said, that's how stupid I was. And told him that. And the minute I said that to him, I found out years later, I was shut out of his plans. Because that little ego I shot back at him, I should have been warned by my father, you know, to get along. And say, oh, yeah, it's a great idea. Let's see what happens. But when he told me that, he was going to beat me. I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon. You're not going to beat me. Stupid. Took me 7 years to learn that. So I went to Houston. I sat in the office with Paul Bosch, and I told you guys before, Mars Siegel come on. He says, what do we have here? Milo Steinborn's son? Yes, I said, Mr. Siegel, my dad, said to say hello. How you doing? He said, well, and Morris moves over to Paul Bosch, and he whispers in his ear out loud so I can hear him. He said, I want you to beat him every night with 300 pounders, and let's see what kind of sympathy we can get from all these teenagers. And he goes to walk off, and he walks over that way to his office. I said, Mr. Siegel. He says, yes. I said, my dad told me to give you a message. Oh, Milo sent me a message? He walks toward me. I says, my dad told me to tell you, if you want me to crap in the ring, I'm supposed to ask you, what color do you want? He looked at Paul. He says, I think we'll do good business with this young man. And I swear to you, 3 weeks later, I was Texas Heavyweight Champion. Excuse me.
How about George Drake?
Georgie Drakey. He committed suicide in San Francisco.
Did he?
And
really?
I'm going to tell you something. You reminded me now, and I'm going to put this in my book. This is the God's honest truth. I was in Japan, and Joe Aguchi told me, he says, one word you must learn here. I said, what's that? He says, chatamati. I said, what does it mean? He says, it means wait a minute. I told you this guy before. It was, when you see a cab driver, you can holler. It all depends on how you deliver it. Chakamate! It's a drag on. Or waitress. Chakamate! It's just a minute. And it all depends on how you deliver it. Well, in Japan, everybody has black hair. In Hollywood, California, the big deal is the blonde hair. In Japan, it's the auburn hair. These Japanese women, some of them who are beautiful, who are streetwalkers, who are entertainers or whatever, they'll take that bleach or whatever, and they'll get it to a point where it's auburn, and it's beautiful. It's different. It's something that... This girl walks out of the hotel, New Japan Hotel, and I see this hair, and I holler, Chatamate. And she turns around, and she comes back to me. She said, you, Mr. Dickie Steinborn, you were wrestled so far. She knew my whole history. I says, you're a wrestling fan. Well, I knew this girl for 6 weeks that I was there, and we were very close. And she was, her name was Noriko. I go back to San Francisco, work for Shires, going back to Georgia. I see George Drake in the dressing room. And I tell him, give him the phone number, I tell him of this woman and so forth. He goes over to Japan. He runs into this girl. He runs into this girl. He falls in love with her. And the reason I found this out was somebody told me that he got a letter from her from Japan, and he took it down where he was living at that hotel in San Francisco. He took it down a block to a somebody, one of the wrestlers told me this. He took it down to the place where they wash your clothes, the Japanese people, and he said, would you translate this? And the letter was from Noriko's father, who was a priest, and he forbid him, George to come back to Japan to see his daughter. He really chastised him and so forth. Shortly thereafter, George committed suicide. Now,
no kidding.
I can't tell you if that was the reason, but about the Pepper Martin, somebody told me in San Francisco about him falling in love with this girl in Japan by the name of Noriko, and she had sent him a Dear John letter, and shortly thereafter he committed suicide. And I'm the one that introduced him to her because he was meant for her. He was that type of guy. He was a nice guy, and he was a, you know, decent looking guy, and he was quiet and easygoing, and she was that type of personality. She was a sweet, lovable person. She was just a lovely person to be around, and I was never introduced to anybody else. So I can't really say I was part of it, but history is history.
What kind of talent was he, Dickie?
Semi-final. He didn't make the main event. Good worker, but never really had that fire, and just the same movements. And it was something that if you were a promoter, you would not utilize him in the main event unless there was an angle or something. But you knew you had a good 20-minute Broadway match, or you had a good 45-minute tag team match with this guy in there, and he was likable. But he never really jumped over that fence. And like the tennis players,
right.
You know, when it's over, some of them went up there and shake hands. Some of them jump over the fence. Excuse me. After playing all those hours? They're telling you what they're like. Well, that's what he was like in the ring. Never worked with him, but watched him work, and he was all right. He reminded me of Jerry London. The up and down guy.
I was to bring up with Jerry London.
You had to have all kinds to make an interesting show. You can't just have all exciting matches. You gotta have a dull one, and you get up, and people get up and go to the bathroom and eat the popcorn, and that's a 45-minute match. But sure enough, toward the end, everybody wants to see what. I don't want to be there. I want to be there, not miss it if it happens to end in 44 minutes or whatever. So it's nothing but psychology.
How about Paul DeMarco?
I liked Paul. He was off the wall.
Yeah.
He was down in Florida. He was off the wall. Uh, You know, when you got a book like Louis Tillett, and he pushes something, and it verbally gets over on TV in Florida, and then I follow through by putting in my little program, and everybody believes in that and so forth, before you know it, the guy gets in the ring, and don't even know if he has any talent or not. He's just over. How many guys can kick and throw and punches and so forth, and as opposed to, like one night in our Gallery, Florida, I was in the dressing room, and I says, it was Briscoe against Matsuda. And I loved working with Jack, and I loved working with Hero, so I'm going to rib him. And it wasn't really a rib, but it turned out to be a rib. I said, listen, I haven't got a cover shot for my Milo's Not program this week, so I want to walk around the ring and shoot pictures of you guys. You should have seen these guys shooting to get in front of the camera. They get the hammer lock, you know, they hook up and you reach over the top and you get the hammer lock, put it behind you, and he's still standing in front of the guy, and he's looking at the camera, and all of a sudden Jack turns him around, and then Matsuda turns him around, and then somebody does something else, and I run around the other side of the room. They were shooting to get the cover shot. I swear. I enjoyed it. I said, I created a monster. Oh, Lord.
All right, here's one for you. Ike Eakins.
Oh, David, Ike Eakins. Big Ike. I remember wrestling him in San Antonio, Texas. And when I went in the ring, I looked at his chest. It like has, if somebody had a little shot glass of ink and threw it at your chest, what would that look like? Splatted all the way up. His was burnt. That afternoon, he had car trouble, and he leaned over to opened up the water.
Radiator.
Thank you. And the whole thing spooled up on his chest. He had burned his whole damn. Oh, jeez. Oh. And I had to work with him. Jesus, it was a stand-up match. But I knew Ike from Florida, and he was a henchman for Cowboy Luttrell. He and Pat O'Hara, when the opposition came to Florida, they would send Ike and Pat to buy tickets to the opposition, and then they would jump in the ring and clean everybody out. Jeez. Oh, they were rough. Ike told me one time.
Go ahead.
Ike told me one time, we were in Japan, and I won't mention the name, but of the guys we were on the chamber, on the tour with, he didn't like this one particular wrestler. And on the train, the bullet train one time, he jumped up and he was almost going to attack the guy. And the guy, we had to stop him, a couple of guys. And the other guy grabbed his belongings and went in the next car. And I got up on the seats on my knees and I leaned over, and I kind of knew Ike for all those years. And I leaned over and I says, Ike, I said, you know, we're on a tour here. And, you know, he said, I don't like that SOB. And he started telling me why and so forth. And all of a sudden, he was irate. He says, I ought to kill that SOB. I said, you don't want to say that. He says, I killed a man already. I said, really, what happened, Ike? And he says, well, I was in Kentucky, Harlem, wherever he was from. He was hoboing, and he says he was down by the railroad tracks, and he and a couple of guys were cooking for some coffee, and he says this black guy walks up. He called him something different. And he says, can I have some coffee? He says, I looked up at him, and he says, the despair I was in, I reached in and got my pistol, and I reached up, and he said, I shot him right between the eyes. I said, you're kidding. He says, nope. He says, and this guy's next. I said, oh, Jesus. And he was at the end of his career. I went to Japan with him, the same thing. He was at the end of his career. You could tell his actions in the ring, and he still loved the. He was really a mark. From the day one, when he first started in the business, he was a mark. He did not know how to wrestle or whatever, but he wanted to be in there, and he wanted to do what he wanted, and he copied people and so forth. Which you could tell. I mean, he didn't have any talent or anything. He was just a big, burly guy, and a good talent, a good hand. But it takes all to make a business. You can't have all main eventers. You got to have somebody going. But when my dad told me, he says, when I saw it happen, Ray Vilma was in Orlando, and he was over there, and Wilbur Snyder came in from Indianapolis, and he called the office. He said, book me coming into Florida, book me in Miami and Lauderdale on a two-week vacation, and then give me about four or five bookers so I can write it off of my tax. So he comes into Orlando, and my dad's got him booked on the first match. And I think he drove in that day, and he says, Milo, I'm tired. He says, how long do you want me to go? And he said, I want you to go 20-minute Broadway. He said, well, you know, I'm bound here just for 2 weeks. He says, listen, I want you to educate these people how to wrestle. And you should have seen that match with Ray Vilma. And it sparked him that somebody, he comes into a territory ready to do a job, and all of a sudden somebody says, no, we want you to show them what you know about wrestling. How good that makes you feel. And that's exactly how he displayed it in the ring that night. Yeah.
Well, Vilma was a shooter anyway, wasn't he?
Yes, he could wrestle. Never knew who he beat. I think George Bolas said something about him one time. I don't know if it was good or bad, but never really. I don't know if he was. I can't recall. I don't want him to say no. You're talking about Snyder, right?
No, I was talking about Vilma. Ray Vilma was.
Oh, yes, Ray could wrestle. Oh, yes. He was. I worked with him a few times, and he got to a point where he was hard to get away from the old school. And Eddie booked me with him in Jacksonville, and I came up with about four high spots, and he didn't want to do them. And Eddie was sitting there listening to him. And I could tell just by Eddie looking at me, because I was a new breed, I was Eddie's partner, and these high spots were half for me and half for him, and he didn't want to do them. It was just a defiant move. I think that ended his move in Florida for the next couple of weeks because Eddie just didn't use him anymore. All because of that. And you know, when you give somebody a high spot, they're going to look good and they're going to turn it down. Losing battle.
What was your first encounter with Frank Hickey? When do you remember him for the first time, if you can remember?
Reading, Pennsylvania or Philadelphia. He come in the dressing room and he opened up that bag and he take that newspaper and he put it down and he put his feet on there. His favorite saying was, pepper tree, pepper tree. That's all you see, pepper tree, pepper tree. But he was a circus nut. He loved the circus. The Filipinos or the Sister Braniel Brown, whatever it was, brothers or sister. And he always had the different colors of the robes and sometimes the bags. It was a circus.
Well, was he ever with the circus or?
I can't tell you that. I don't know. But he had those wild, goofy costumes. And I think the promoters booked him because of the costumes. And they were all the authentic colors of the circus people. I mean, you had these different families that did wire walking and tumbling and so forth, and the Madison Square Garden Circus every year featured them, and they all had certain colors. They were South Americans and Brazilians, and he just, you know, he was a fanatic. I'm sure he was a kid, and he went to the circus, and he fell in love with that, and excuse me, and somehow in his mind, not knowing how to wrestle, he convinced somebody, put yourself in his shoes. He doesn't know how to wrestle, but he got this fixation in his mind. He's going to succeed one way or the other. When he gets enough money, he buys the robes and so forth, and he finds somebody who's going to book him. And sure, he's going to do a job. He learns how to do it well. I mean, when he came in that ring, he twirled around with that robe. He spun it around. You thought he was in the circus.
It was
a fixation.
My first encounter. Did you ever wrestle in?
Oh, a couple of times in New York. When I was younger, but I don't remember.
My first encounter with him was when we come back up from Florida in 1970. I wrestled him in Statesboro, Georgia. I've never seen anything like it, right? So we can get out there, probably the second match or whatever it was. Bell rings, go out there, and I hook up with him. You know what he said to me? I remember this the day I die. He said, "Hey, kid, are you smart to the business?" I hope God strikes me dead. He didn't tell me that.
You know what?
That was in 1970. He told me that.
When you'd be in the dressing room, he'd always do this in New York. You'd be working with him, right? And you go to the bathroom just before you go to the ring. He'd stick his head around the door in the bathroom and say, "Wash your hands, wash your hands. You're working with me." He'd say it all the time.
I never was in the ring with him, but I met him through Renesto. You know, I told y'all that he trained Tom Renesto.
Oh, he did. Really?
Yes.
Tom told me that. California? California?
Yeah.
Tom
told me that.
No kidding.
Yep.
Jeez.
That's why Tom used it. I mean, when he was in here, I was running errands for Harbin and putting up the TV ring. This must have been 71, 72, the last time he came through here. Tom used him because, you know, Tom just had a soft spot for him. But he had gotten really bad by that time. He'd be flat on his back in the ring, and he'd cup his hands over his mouth and holler, "I spotted a guy that had a step-over toe hold standing straight up." it really had gotten bad.
You won't believe this, but Tom used him again in 1979 in Memphis.
Oh, jeez.
When Tom was booking in Memphis, he came in and did a TV job.
How old would he have been?
Probably he had to have been in his 70s by that point.
Oh, at least.
But, you know, he wasn't the only spaceman in the wrestling business. Do you know that? There was one other. He wasn't the only one that used a spaceman gimmick.
Who was the other one?
There was a guy named Zuma Man from Mars. I don't know
if that was a separate
gimmick or not, but you know who it was?
Who?
Carl Engstrom.
Who?
His name, Carl Engstrom.
Oh, you're kidding.
Nope.
I knew Carl real well. Puerto Rico.
He wore the space helmet and everything. Looked like something out of a Buck Rogers serial.
Yeah, I remember. Carl Engstrom, he was...
Man.
He was a dancing instructor outside the wrestling business. He and his wife owned a dancing school in somewhere around Chicago.
Mm-hmm. I got a name I want to throw at you, Dick. This one's in my time, so I know you got a good story here. Tell me something about Bill Dromo.
There's nothing unusual about him. No,
that's the best line of the night.
I was in Australia for 6 months, and I sort of stayed in a hotel. I got an apartment right on the King's Cross, like the favorite place everybody goes to. And I had Pepe Gomez as my roommate. I had Bach Winkle as my roommate. And then when they left, Bill Dromo came in and took over my place. That's the only thing I know with him. But then I knew him in Georgia. That's about it. Just, you know, Bill and I have been friends for years. I know he's got a Parkinson's disease right now.
Yeah.
So he's shaking pretty bad.
I'm sitting here a week ago Saturday. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. I was actually in the kitchen. Phone rings. Wife answers the phone. She goes, "Telephone." "Well, who is it?" "It's Dromo." "Okay." So I come in here and he goes, "You got your TV on?" And I went, "Well, no." He said, "Well, turn it on." And he said, "Put it on channel such and such." And I put it on, and there was nothing there. And I said, "What am I looking for?" I said, "We don't have the same." I said, "I got a satellite, and you're probably on a cable." And he goes, I'm looking at these midgets and Hulk Hogan." And I said,
"Oh,
well, okay." So I looked. I found it. And I hadn't seen it. I'd heard about it. But all he did was sit for 5 minutes and grunt into the phone while I watched this with him.
He did what?
He just sat and grunted. Every time they'd do something on TV, he'd grunt.
Rocket
grunt.
Oh yeah, you know, just and if Rocket Monroe had lived long enough to see it, he would have called me and fussed for an hour and listened. That was the darndest thing I'd ever seen. I watched about 10 minutes of it and cut it off. But yeah, Dromo called a grunt in the phone at me for about 10 minutes over this Hulk Hogan thing.
Why did you have to bring that up? I mean, we were going so good.
Well, I think we've been talking about the good stuff. I think you have to look at the bad too.
Oh God!
And that's just
I keep saying this all the time. We all talk about what happened yesterday, last week, 10 years ago in our careers and so forth, and we have all these fond memories. Now, let's use it like a pendulum. It's gone to the left. Now, let's go to the middle and go to the right. What the hell is it going to be like in 40 years?
It's going to spin all the way around, I guess.
If you were a booker, how would you draw money in 40 years from now? 40 years from now? If you were a booker, how would you, not what we think they're going to do, each individual, you and I and everybody else and Bobby and everybody, we have our own ideas.
Yep.
Somebody's going to come along in 40 years from now with their ideas, and they're going to pick up what they've done 20 years from now and 30 years from now, and they're going to be doing something just as great. Like The Rock. The Rock is coming back with the WWE. Even I was excited. They feed you with somebody for a couple of years, and they take them away, put them in a movie, and get their fans, and they put them on something CD and get their fans, and then they bring them back to the WWE. That's fantastic booking. I mean, you're talking about world booking. All you need is the talent.
That's the problem.
Yeah. That's the whole hold up right there.
When somebody has the talent, it's up to the promoter or the booker to say, let me do something with this talent. Let me put a mask on this talent. Eventually, in other words, I could use the mask on this guy for a year and then take the mask off and then continue on for another year like you want to do right now without the mask. So you got 2 years out of the guy instead of 1 year out of the guy.
Well, this man that we all know is dead and gone, but he could come back in 40 years and do it, and that'd be Leo Garibaldi.
Oh, yeah.
My prediction is this. If somebody had enough money, they could come together and form a corporation. And this corporation would pay the bills. And the bills would be for 13 weeks of one-hour recordings of Civil War wrestling. Let's go back to 1864. When the states separated and so forth. Don't you know that the North had wrestlers and the South had wrestlers? And it was in history, in Lynchburg, Virginia, where the river was, at nighttime, the Southerners took the little boats and came across and fought the Northerners in the ring in wrestling, boxing, and a game they call faro. And by 5 o'clock in the morning, they got their little boats and went across and they fired each other at the evenings. It's history. And it could be done all over again and recorded. I remember watching years ago some television show about battlefields, and it was Civil War. Why can't it be where you open up the show with a wrestling match and you close the show with a wrestling match? And next week it's in Lynchburg. And next week it's in Leesburg, Virginia. And the Civil War of 4 years, 86% of the battles in 4 years were fought in the state of Virginia. The big ones were Maryland, which was Gettysburg and so forth, but 86% of all the battles, little skirmishes and so forth. And there you have Custer, who wound up in Montana being slaughtered by the Indians. Yet, he was in a battle in Leesburg, Virginia, 50 miles north of Richmond. So there is Custer seconding the matches of one of his lieutenants who's in the ring in 1863 taking on one of the Northerners.
Well, he should have stayed in the wrestling business.
He had blonde hair. He had George Short.
That's what I'm talking about. He could have hung around long enough and hooked up with Rogers or something.
You know, if you guys ever have a chance, get the book Roots. Well, look it up on the internet. It is the most fascinating book about this young guy in Africa, and all of a sudden he comes across the United States, and then and he's on a farm, and that's Alex Haley's. That's Alex Haley's background, and he goes all the way back to where there were slaves, and they were captured in Africa and so forth. Roots, it's called. Well, you got roots in wrestling. You know, even I don't care if it's 1 year in the territory. You go on the internet and get 52 programs from Orlando every Monday night, and there's all the matches. And all you got to do is figure it out, and you figure out what the bookers were doing, and then figure it out the TV, and say, there's a story. Right there. There's an educational story that should be told and recorded.
Well, I've long thought Ken Burns ought to do, who did the Civil War documentary that was on PBS. He's done one on jazz music. He's done one on blues music. He needs to
right.
do one on the professional wrestling business.
You're right. Exactly right. Exactly right.
Be his main spokesman. You know, every time he with the Civil War, he had Shelby Foote, who was a Civil War historian and, author and all that stuff. And I think if I can find Ken Burns' phone number, I'm going to call him in 56 time board to us. Because I'm all about photographs. You can be the star that they make out of it. He did baseball. Baseball was probably my favorite that he did. And
yes, yes.
That was, but somebody really ought to look, go back as far as, the times you're talking about in the Civil War days. And, William Muldoon was the first American heavyweight professional wrestling champion. And,
right.
And figure out just when it became a work. I think it was always a work myself. But
the biggest work I heard was Hackenschmidt. Hackenschmidt was from Germany, and he was tough, and he was strong, and he was a weightlifter. And he was the size of somebody you could hardly handle. I think 5'10 and a half or something, and 248 pounds. And the publicity was always in newspapers, and he was in, I think he was in England at the time. And the newspaper came across, I think when the AP or the UP hit the market and they started hearing from publicity from other people all over the world, it came from India. There was a guy by the name of Gama who was undefeated, who drew thousands of people, and he declared himself the world's champion. Nobody could beat him. So Hackenschmidt and his managers started to work a publicity campaign and saying, we can beat him. It took a couple of months, and finally they challenged the match. And Hackenschmidt sent $25,000. No. Gama sent $25,000 worth of rubies or something from India to England to wrestle Hackenschmidt. And what he didn't realize was, in all his life, he's trained in the sand. And when he got to England, he had to get up in the ring with canvas. And he lost. And for 6 months, he refused to go back on the boat to India because he had lost face. And then when the publicity came out that it was the difference between a ring and sand, and they really publicized on that, they offered Hackenschmidt $45,000 if he would come back to India and take on Gama. And by the time the money came across the boat, so 4 or 5 months later, he accepted it. He is on the way back to India. The story is there was 110,000 people in this oval, and the guys on the top of the oval had these big long rifles with the widened end of the guns, and they were firing them in the air before the matches went on. Now, you talk about a work. Now, Hackenschmidt was a shooter, and so was Gama. And what do you think happened? Hackenschmidt lost in 10 seconds. I kid you not.
I've got to ask you this. When your dad took you over there, when you was very young. Did you ever meet him?
Meet who?
Hackenschmidt.
I can't remember. No. My
you
brother.
Never met him.
No, my brother and my dad. I was thinking about Maserati. No, my brother and my dad went to England, went to Germany to see his sisters, and dropped back to England for the Mr. Olympia contest. And I think that's where Schwarzenegger won the Mr. Olympia, I think. No, maybe it was Andre Drop. Anyway, Hackenschmidt was there, and he talked to him there with my brother. And that's the last.
I saw pictures of him, man. For back then, my God,
he was
carved out of granite.
Yeah.
He's a freak, man.
Some guys are just built like that, but he had those big traps too. And he was a weightlifter, strong, and a powerful wrestler. Wasn't he Russian? Wasn't he Russian or German?
He was German.
He
was Russian.
He was Russian, but he wound up living in England after he toured the States.
I see.
Yeah, but he was the Russian Lion, is what they called him.
That's it. That's it.
And,
your dad, not long before he passed away, I'd call him and talk to him, you know. So how he got talking about Hackenschmidt. So he was in England, right, when he died?
Yeah.
So your dad told me, it might have been the trip you're talking about when him and Henry went. But anyhow, he said he went, he looked him up. So he goes and knocks on the door. This is your daddy telling me the story. And he knocks on the door. So his wife comes to the door, and he said, he told her who, he was there to see George. And she said, well, let me go get him. So your daddy said, here comes Big George. Out of the back. He said, a towel around his neck. I guess he's doing neck bridges or something. I think your dad said he was like 90 then. He said he was huge. And he saw your dad, and he hollered, Zabisco, Zabisco. He thought he was Stan Los Zabisco. and your daddy told me, he said, he's not there. He knew he was one of the boys, but he couldn't play. I'll never forget that story. He's not there. What stories, huh?
Yeah.
Well, guys, I'm going to wind it up, Jerry. I know you've got something you've got to do, and I've got some paperwork and stuff I've got to get ready for a meeting I've got in the morning. So I want to wrap it up. Good to be back on the air, and Dick.
It sure is.
Appreciate you joining us, and we got through about half my list. We'll have to do this again and get to the second half of it.
Before we go, can I tell you my favorite joke?
Yes,
sir.
Here it goes. The guy was at work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He says, you know, I think there's something going on at my house. My girlfriend's upstairs on the third floor. I want to leave work. So he goes home, and he crawls upstairs. He goes in the house. He looks in the bedroom, and his girlfriend's laying on the bed, and he goes in the kitchen, and he looks at the kitchen window's open, and he looks out the kitchen window, looks down, and there's a guy getting in the convertible. He says, that's him. He's the one. I know it's him. So he decides to destroy this guy, so he backs up. He unplugs the refrigerator. He slides it over to the window. He tilts it over to the windowsill. He pushes the refrigerator out the windowsill, and it goes down three floors, and it kills this guy in the convertible. And while he's looking out the window, he says, what did I do? Gosh. And he has a heart attack. And he lays there dead on the windowsill with his arms hanging outside. And the next scene is St. Peter's Golden Gate. And St. Peter says, this big lion, he says, next! The guy comes up, he says, St. Peter, you won't believe this. I've been going to work every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They just bought this new convertible, and this refrigerator came out of the sky and killed me. St. Peter says, a likely story, but go on in, son. Next in line, the guy said, St. Petey, you won't believe this. He says, I thought my girlfriend was messing around. I put this refrigerator and I pushed it out the window. And I know I did something wrong. I died of a heart attack. He said, likely story going on in. He says, next. The next guy comes up. He says, you won't believe this. I was in this refrigerator. Good night, you guys.
Bye, Dickie.
Oh,
guys, you got anything you want to plug before we go off the air?
No, sir, I'm done. I enjoyed this.
I had fun. I missed you guys.
Missed you, all of you.
Yeah, long drought, 2 weeks not doing this.
Well, how is the Jerry Oaks Natural Products, how's that business going?
It's going good.
Good.
Like anything else, it could be better, but I thank God for it.
Listen, if we got 2 minutes, I mean, this story that broke in Ohio over the last couple of days, man, I'm surprised they didn't fly you up there being the game warden or the animal control guy.
I disconnected my phone.
You know, I sat there today, and I was watching the CNN or something, and they had Jack Hanna, the guy that used to be on.
Right.
You know, and he's the head of the zoo in Columbus, Ohio, and he said something that I'm an animal lover. We have cats and we love animals, but he said that they killed 26 Bengal tigers.
That's hideous.
Now, I understand they probably didn't have any choice. I mean, you know, one guy said they were trying tranquilizers, but they didn't know if it worked, and you can't let a hungry tiger just roam around the neighborhood. But he said 26 was killed in a matter of 36 hours, and there's only 1,400 of those beautiful cats left in the wild.
But you see, I that's the first. I mean, I knew this happened, but I wouldn't read it anywhere or listen to it. My heart goes out to animals. I mean, animals are helpless. These animals were helpless, and I mean, of course, they had to do what they had to do. But when I hear something like that, it makes me absolutely nauseated.
Oh, me too. Me too.
I just can't take it.
It just
breaks my heart.
The guy that I guess he just had his own private menagerie, and I guess when he decided it was time to. For him to do away with himself, he was just going to set his animals free.
Yeah. Well, he had just got out of prison for something.
Oh, really?
It was a strange story.
Yeah.
Strange story.
Well, it's a sad story.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
Hmm. But
need to call in Jerry Oaks.
I kept looking for Jerry Oaks to be on TV, you know, up there tracking these tigers roaming through the woods and stuff.
I left a message on my phone. Jerry Oaks going to Bangkok for 2 weeks.
Oh.
Y'all are crazy, Lord.
We have 16 cats that travel with us. And they're a mixture of Bengals and Siberians. And I can't tell you how many of each we've got, but just within the last couple of months, we have debuted one of our white. We've got 3 white ones to travel with us, and they're the youngest. And we just debuted one of them. Because it takes a couple of years to train them as they're coming up to where they're, you know, able to perform. And these cats are just gorgeous. Every one of them.
They're gorgeous. Most beautiful animals in the world.
I think it's the prettiest animal the good Lord made.
They're gorgeous.
And
I hate that.
I read somewhere one time that said that more people were killed in India by being eaten by tigers than they were any other way at one time. And I went to the circus here in Atlanta when Michael was here this year, here at the racetrack. I wouldn't get in there with them.
I wouldn't either.
I mean, you know, it just takes one to say, you know, I'm having a bad day and this fella here is about the right size. I mean, and they look at me and think buffet, so I'm not, you know, I'm not getting in there with them.
I just eat everything, bones and everything. So if you haven't got anybody you want to get rid of.
But I bet it costs a lot of money to feed those kids. I bet it costs a lot of money to feed them, doesn't it, Mike?
Yeah, they truck in
need. They own them on a special diet and everything, and you know, meat can't be, you know, only so many days old or whatever it is because of what they have to eat and to protect their teeth and their coats and all that stuff. And, you know, we have our own ends with the beta people, and, you know, and I understand to a point what they're protesting and stuff like that, but just like anybody else that has an agenda like that, they go way overboard.
Yeah, they do.
Our animals are highly pampered, all of them. I mean, you know, they're the stars of our show.
Exactly.
They are well taken care of.
I'm sure they are.
Some of the other performers are. And all of our animals are raised in captivity. They live twice as long in captivity as they would in the wild. You know, but people don't see that at this side of it. But, see, I'm like Bobby. I see Judith and Jurgen. Judith is the woman, and Jurgen is her husband. And it's amazing to me that they get in there, and then those cats respond to them. But, you know, of course, they raise them from cubs, and but still, you know, you're talking about a 375-pound animal who all he's got to do is reach out and swat at you, and, you know.
You're done.
Yeah, the guy, I guess was it Siegfried or Roy? They found out the hard way.
Yeah.
Just
sooner or later, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, guys, we will get together again next Thursday, and do this again. I should be free to do the show all the way up until November 17th, which is a Thursday, which is the first night of shows in Fort St. Lucie. We'll miss that night. And then after that, I am done with the circus for the season, and we'll go from there. But we shouldn't be missing other than that show. We shouldn't be missing any more shows. So.
That's great, guys.
Sounds good to me.
Alrighty, well, I will talk to you guys next week, and thanks again to Dick Steinwald for joining us, and hopefully we'll have him again on in the future. He's our unofficial producer, so, you know,
that's right.
All right, guys, have a great week.
Y'all too. Right. Good night.
See you. Bye.
Talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.